Jeff Levering and wife Ashley love their new patio door from Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin.
It's like having a brand new kitchen.
I love the roll screen. The fact that the screen is on the inside.
Get 0% interest for up to 48 months. Visit PellaWI.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. Hope you all had a wonderful weekend. A lot of stuff going on. And, of course, this week we'll be taking you into next week's Memorial Day weekend as well. Look at the weather forecast. It seems like it is finally, I say finally, getting nicer. And isn't that wonderful? Well, one thing that isn't changing, though, unlike the weather, is the degree of violence and carnage on the roadways. For those of you not keeping score at home, Saturday, 7 people wounded in shootings, including a 17-year-old boy. Milwaukee shootings left 5 people wounded Saturday, including a 17-year-old boy. Police arrested 2 people in connection with one of the 5 crimes. They are looking for others. There was the shooting on 25th and Hadley. 31-year-old Milwaukee man was shot around 1 a.m., taken to a hospital. He is expected to survive. Minutes later, a 32-year-old Milwaukee woman was shot and taken to a hospital around Tetonia and North. She is expected to survive. A 36-year-old man and a 41-year-old woman were taken into custody as a result of that. The drumbeat of violence goes on. Fond du Lac and Hampton, a 24-year-old Milwaukee woman was shot just after 2 a.m. and taken to a hospital. By the way, you notice one of the things that's going on here, it's all late at night. Wagner's Rule of Life number 4, nothing good happens outside a strip club at 2 a.m., and nothing at all good happens on the mean streets of Milwaukee, certainly after midnight. Then, let's see, shortly before 3 p.m. on Saturday, 16th and Meineke, 37-year-old Milwaukee man was shot. He's taken to a hospital. 17-year-old boy shot at the park near 8th and Brown around 5:40 p.m. He was taken to the hospital. The beat of violence goes on. 19-year-old Milwaukee man was shot near 39th and Lisbon around 9:30 p.m. And then, let's see, a 17-year-old boy was shot near 14th and South Muskego Avenue in Milwaukee around 11:30 p.m. Saturday. That was a non-fatal injury. But that is quite a roll call. You have 7 shootings from 12 a.m. Saturday morning, so that's Friday nights into Saturday morning, till 12 p.m. on Saturday night, Sunday morning. I mean, what a string of violence that is going on. And in all these cases, the good news is there were no fatalities. But as we frequently talk about on this program, anytime you have a shooting, it could just as easily be a homicide. It's but for essentially bad aim or the grace of God or whatever that you don't have that situation happening. And then, of course, the carnage on the roadways continues. Early Sunday morning, 2 a.m., so this is Saturday night into Sunday morning, a 14-year-old girl killed in a crash on I-794. Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department said it happened after 2 a.m. after police in St. Francis reported to police in Cudahy that there was a speeding driver going over 110 miles an hour on I-794 southbound near Pennsylvania Avenue. We're going to talk more about I-794 in just a couple minutes. The vehicle, a Chevy sedan, rolled over and crashed down an embankment west of Pennsylvania Avenue. There were 4 people in the vehicle. The sheriff's department said the driver, a 17-year-old girl, was doing CPR on the 14-year-old who died. Other Good Samaritans also stopped to try to help. The 14-year-old was pronounced dead at the scene despite the efforts to save her. 2 other people in the car were taken to the hospital with minor injuries. The 17-year-old driver was arrested for OWI drugs with additional charges pending. My understanding is, as has been happening frequently, the car flipped and landed down the embankment on Pennsylvania Avenue. The driver, the girl, the 14-year-old who died, had been ejected from the back seat and was unconscious. So as we talked about repeatedly over the last couple of weeks, when I see the phrase ejected, that tells me they weren't wearing a seatbelt. And again, I don't know that if the 14-year-old had been wearing a seatbelt, if that turns out to be the case. But again, if you're wearing a seatbelt and a shoulder harness, you're not, as a general rule, ejected. Don't know if they would have survived, but I do know that when you are in a horrific automobile accident and you are not wearing your shoulder harness and seatbelt, the chances of you walking away from it are less. It's not a guarantee that you're going to survive, but it's less. But yet, that's the common thing now. Now, what's the other dazzling detail about this horrible story? It's 2 in the morning. You've got a 17-year-old who is allegedly drunk, driving 110 miles an hour. You've got a 14-year-old that's in the back seat of the car. What are these kids doing out on the street at that time of night? What are the kids doing out on the street at 2 a.m. in the morning, much less drunk, much less driving 110 miles an hour? So many of these horrible situations would not happen if kids were where they were supposed to be, which is not on the streets at 2 o'clock in the morning, whether it's to be in a car where there's some drunk 17-year-old driving 110 miles an hour, or, you know, a kid that's on the streets at 3 o'clock in the morning and ends up getting shot. If we would have, whether it's parents or guardians or whatever, enforcement of curfew rules, any of this stuff, to get the kids off the streets, because nothing good happens for adults outside at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I guarantee you nothing good happens on the streets after 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when you are talking about teenagers or younger. So another tough weekend in Milwaukee when it comes to violence and when it comes to carnage on the roadways. And once again, we ask that question that we ask all the time about this stuff. When are people going to say enough is enough? So very glad to have you with us. It is possible to be right and wrong over time. For example, back in 2002, you will remember that because the former mayor of Milwaukee, John Norquist, hated freeways. He just hated freeways with a passion. He was a huge advocate when he was the mayor for tearing down what was known as the Park East Freeway. Back in 1970, there was a spur that was built off of I-43 that went east. The ultimate plan was to hook up that freeway spur with the freeway heading south down along the lake. It never happened. So you had this little freeway spur that ended up going east of the river and then kind of dumping out onto city streets. All right. Norquist hated that and pushed strong to tear it down. And the argument was, if you tear down this Park East Freeway, it's going to free up all this land that's under this little freeway spur, and what's going to happen is you're going to have all this development. Well, he was wrong, but ultimately right. He was wrong because for the better part of, well, a decade and a half, 15 or 16 years, that area around underneath the Park East Freeway was what could charitably be described as a moonscape. There was just no development. There was nothing going on. Then what happened is you had the Milwaukee Bucks and the deal with the state, and you had Fiserv Forum being built. And when Fiserv Forum was constructed, that served as a catalyst for development around the Park East. I feel safe in saying that if Fiserv Forum had not been created, that whole area under the Park East would still be a moonscape. But it was created. You had the Deer District, and it brought other development down there. So, yeah, for all of us who said, like, tearing this down in 2002 isn't going to lead to economic development, we were correct for 15 or 16 years, and then suddenly you got this once-in-a-lifetime thing, okay, we're going to build the new facility. But having said that, what's going on right now is a renaissance in that area. There is development along the Park East. So that is now kind of playing out in these conversations that are being had with regard to I-794. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with this, and this is now a route that I drive every day to try to get to work, as you are taking I-43 south into the city, or if you are coming from the east to the west, from the west to the east on I-94, there is a freeway spur, I-794, which connects, again, I-43 and I-94, and it takes it and hooks into what we call the Lake Freeway. It takes you over the Hone Bridge and then down to the airport and all those sorts of things. There are a group of people who are basically they're anti-car folks, and they are saying what we should do with I-794 is we should do the same thing we did with the Park East Freeway. Now, the difference with I-794 is it connects. I mean, the Park East Freeway never connected with anything. It just dumped out east of the river. Now, I-794, let's say you want to get on it and you want to take it and you want to hook up to the Lake Freeway and then go down, it allows you to connect that way. Similarly, if you live in Bayview or South Milwaukee or Cudahy or whatever, you can come up the Lake Freeway and then you can use that I-794 spur to go west if you live in Brookfield or if you want to work in Brookfield, or go north if you work in Ozaukee County or whatever. So this freeway, unlike the Park East Freeway, it connects. But the argument is, if we tear this down, it will spur development under the bridge, essentially, and it'll spur development, under the freeway, which currently, runs a few miles. Now, what's happening is you have a number of people on the south side who are saying, wait a minute, if we tear this down, it is going to significantly impact the ability of people who live on the south side to get to other places. Our number, 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. All right, is this a freeway spur that should be torn down? We discuss in just a moment. Yes. Which is the old National Bank talk and text line. Now, look, I'm willing to concede that back in early 2000, when they tore down the Park East Freeway, I was one of these people arguing that you were not going to have any sort of degree of economic development in that space. I was right for 15 or 16 years. Finally, you had the once-in-a-lifetime decision to build the Fiserv Forum, had the Bucks that put a ton of money in there, and now you do have economic development. But you didn't for 15 years, and I'm willing to bet that you wouldn't to this day were it not for the building of Fiserv Forum, which, again, created that development. The same argument is now being made. Let's tear down I-794. I-794 is, of course, the freeway spur that connects I-94 from the west and I-43 from the north that allows people to go into the city and also then hook up with the Lake Freeway that takes them down to the south side. I think tearing down that freeway, which does serve a huge purpose. For example, everyone who lives on the south side, not everyone, but many people who live on the south side, that's their access point to come into Milwaukee and to use it to go west or to go north, because it all does connect now. And to tear that down on the idea of, well, okay, we're going to make people get off the freeway, then they're going to drive on surface streets, and then presumably go 10 blocks and pick up the freeway again, that is absurd. And the idea that if you tear down the freeway, which actually does serve a purpose, that, oh, there's going to be all this economic development that's going to come under the area. I don't think so. 855-616-1620. Let's talk to Steve in Oak Creek. Steve, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff, and you're absolutely correct. The old Park East Freeway had no purpose, so it was great that it got torn down. But 794, as it's been redone over the years, clearly has a purpose, and that purpose has already helped to develop along the lakefront and in the Third Ward. So taking it down wouldn't serve any purpose. It would just complicate things further. Remember back in the days when there was the Bridge to Nowhere that had a cameo appearance in
the Blues Brothers,
film The Blues Brothers?
Sure.
Yeah, so that already got taken care of, so that 794 has a clear purpose and that purpose is working just fine today.
Well, right, and it is a major for people who live where you live, Steve, in Oak Creek or in Cudahy or South Milwaukee or Bayview or whatever. It is one of the major access points to get to downtown or get west or get north. Why you would tear it down and make it so much more difficult for people is absolutely beyond me.
I agree completely.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 855-616-1620. Let's talk to Chris in New Berlin. Chris, you're on WTMJ.
Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris.
I think we absolutely need to keep it because unlike the hop, people actually use it. I come from New Berlin, and south is fine, but my niece is a dance major at UWM, and the number of times I've come down 794, gotten to the lakefront, gone north to get to UWM. So even that connects to the freeway instead of winding through city streets, et cetera, and you know, right. Taking 43 north and then heading east, I'm not comfortable going through some of the subdivision I have to go through just to get there, as opposed to kind of going around some of the.
Also, it makes your drive
areas.
A lot longer, Chris. I mean, you know, if you're coming like up the Lake Freeway and you have to swing around all the way to go west to pick up I-43 and then go all the way north to get off on Locust or whatever you're going to get off on, and then have to come all the way east, they're adding significant time to your commute for no good purpose.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, thanks for calling. That's interesting, and that's from the perspective of New Berlin. Let's talk to Wayne in St. Francis. Wayne, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Just a point that I wanted to make, talking to your screener, is you have underneath that freeway right now, there's a lot of parking that is utilized for the Third Ward, which helps their business quite a bit.
Right.
And they want to eliminate that by making it a boulevard.
Right.
I don't see any value with that. And trying to access Summerfest and the lakefront, driving through there, if it were a boulevard, I don't think that the people in the Third Ward would appreciate any more traffic.
Right.
Trying to get through there just to access those facilities.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, it's just a stunningly bad idea, no matter how you cut it. Now, again, it's being pushed by these people who don't like cars and who essentially want to keep people as prisoners of the city. The idea being, if we make it impossible to or really unpleasant for people to drive around, or drive through, well, then they'll choose to live in the city. Well, no, they'll just find alternative routes. But to the point that every single caller is making and almost all of our texters are making, this is something that works. Marion Brookfield says, it makes absolutely no sense. We're trying to build our port, and this will have a negative, you know, impact. You know, Jeff, if they tear it down and build a surface street big enough to handle the traffic load, what land will have been opened up? You know, very important. Don't tear it down. I-794, it's an important link to the southern suburbs. Whoever is thinking of this must not live on the south side. Well, it's not just that. I mean, okay, so I live north of the city, right? But it is an alternative way of, for example, when you go to the airport, it's an alternative way of getting to and from the airport if there's construction or congestion or a collision on 4394 going south. It's an alternative route, and it is a route that is used on a regular basis. And like I say, that's what distinguishes it from the Park East Freeway, which was always a bad idea to begin with. But this is something that is used. It's used by real people, and I like one of our callers, unlike the hop that we spent tens of millions of dollars on and nobody rides, this is something that is actually used on a regular basis. And I hope the powers that be, starting in Madison, don't cave in to some of the anti-car extremists who are deciding that they want to make it more and more difficult for people to get around in southeastern Wisconsin. And this idea that you're going to have all sorts of economic development, well, yeah, that's the same sort of people that told you that the hop would be paying for itself and that you'd have thousands and thousands of people paying to ride it. I don't think so. Jeff, whoever is thinking of this should have to explain what they're thinking. Jeff, at the street level, you need a drawbridge over the Milwaukee River. Huge delays on summer weekends. Jeff, Northwestern Mutual is closing their Franklin campus, and 2,000 or 3,000 employees they have now will be driving downtown, many of them from the south side, and they're going to tear down the 794 connection. More people headed downtown, less ways to get there. Really smart. Jeff, my daughter is a trauma surgeon, practices at the medical college. She has to be within a certain number of minutes from the hospital in case of an emergency. She lives in the third ward. If this happens, she's not going to be able to stay there. I do not agree with the plan. Jeff, of course you're right. 794 should we be kept? Who do we contact, complain to, keep it? All right, I'll give you an idea on that in just a minute. Bottom line is, oh, Jeff, the Oak Creek Postal Annex on East College Avenue was specifically built in its current location due to its access to 794. All those texts are absolutely correct. And yet you've got people who are saying, let's tear it down to open up more city space. Wonderful. When we come back, an interest group says, don't go to Florida. What do you think about that? We'll discuss. So very glad to have you on with us on a very, very nice Monday. And by the way, we've been doing this for the last couple of weeks now. If you want to watch us, we've got our own YouTube channel. We stream the show in addition to broadcasting it over the internet. You can simply go to WTMJ.com and you can click on the Listen Live if you want to listen to us. You can also click on the Watch Live button and you can see us as we do spoken word radio from inside our studio here at WTMJ. And a number of people are finding us that way. By the way, I would also be remiss if I didn't mention our podcasts, because I know a lot of you listen to, maybe you listen to a half hour of the show or something, and then, you know, you want to hear the rest of it. We very much appreciate that. And you can follow my show and all our WTMJ shows anywhere you get your podcasts, whether you can subscribe to them through WTMJ.com or Spotify or, you know, Apple. It's just, we are there. You can get us any way you choose. All right. It's been a real interesting thing because this is a political story and it's not a political story. There is, in some respects, a disconnect in the mainstream media. The mainstream media hates Donald Trump, right? It just hates Donald Trump. During the 4 years that Donald Trump was president, I always used to say this, the New York Times, for example, or the Washington Post, even if they agreed with something that Trump was going to do, that the story was written with a negative spin because they hated Donald Trump. It was one of those situations where if Trump came out and gave a reporter a $100 bill, the story would be the reporter complaining because, well, where can you spend a $100 bill? I've got to go break it into 520s. That's it. So they hate Donald Trump. But at the same time, when Trump was president, because lots of other people hated Donald Trump, they gave Trump all this attention because it helped generate people clicking on the websites and things like that, or watching the sort of left-wing newscasts at night. So that was what the appeal was. So it was this love-hate relationship with Trump. So now Trump is running for president. Many of us do not believe on the right that he is electable. As a matter of fact, many people on the left don't believe he's electable as well. I think the general perspective is, among Democrats, that if it's Biden versus Trump, a rerun of 2020, Trump loses. I think that that's correct. I think he's going to lose big. In addition, with Trump at the top of the ballot, there's all sorts of things out there suggesting that down-ballot Republicans, that means Republicans running for Senate, for Congress, for governor, all the way down, that they are going to lose as well because Trump is a drag. So on the one hand, you have Democrats who, in a weird way, want to see Trump be the nominee. Because if Trump is the nominee, their candidate, in this case Joe Biden, has a greater chance to win. So one of the things that is happening now is you have, as more Republicans are emerging to challenge Donald Trump, you have more and more of an effort to try to discredit them. Let's attack Ron DeSantis. Let's attack Chris Christie. Let's attack Tim Scott. More on Tim Scott later in the program. Let's attack these people. Let's run them down because we want Trump to be the nominee. Because if Trump is the nominee, well, Biden has a bigger chance of winning. DeSantis is the nominee, it's a completely different story, which is why as Ron DeSantis moves closer to running, and the announcement, I believe he's going to announce that he's going to run for president sometime this week, as he moves closer to that decision to run, what happens is he's getting more and more attacks that come on. So this is what happens over the weekend. The NAACP, which is an advocacy organization. Here's the story in the Wall Street Journal. The NAACP issues travel advisory for openly hostile Florida. The advocacy group for Black Americans says the move is in response to actions by Governor Ron DeSantis. The NAACP issued a travel advisory for Florida over the weekend to warn potential tourists of state laws and policies that the group sees as hostile to LGBT people and people of color. The statement says tourists should understand that Florida is openly hostile towards African Americans, people of color, and LGBTQ individuals. So they're issuing these advisories. Now, of course, let's understand what's going on here. This is all about an effort to try to discredit and or embarrass Ron DeSantis, to weaken him as he gets ready to announce that he's going to run for president. Well, I want to talk about the general concept. So you've got the NAACP issuing a travel advisory. Don't go to Florida. Our number, 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Is anybody going to listen? I remember, let's just talk about recent history, Georgia. And you had all these attacks when Georgia was passing some voting laws and things like that. And you had Joe Biden coming on saying, this is going to be Jim Crow 2.0. All this just overheated rhetoric that was nothing but a bunch of poppycock. But it was overheated rhetoric. Here, don't go to Georgia. Don't do this. Don't do that. It pretty much fizzled. So you've got the NAACP and a couple other interest groups who don't like Ron DeSantis and are trying to, again, undercut Ron DeSantis. They're issuing travel advisory saying don't go to Florida. Is anybody going to listen? 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Will this hurt the state of Florida in any way, shape, or form? I'll give you my ideas and we'll discuss in just a moment. 855-616-1620. 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. I would say a half dozen of our the tweets, the texts that we just received essentially make this point. Jeff, I'm curious, has the NAACP issued a travel advisory about going to Chicago? And if not, how can anyone view their advisory about travel to Florida as anything but politically motivated? Have you looked at the crime that is going on, particularly black-on-black crime in the city of Chicago? Number of people making that point. But no, the week that Ron DeSantis is getting ready to announce that he's going to run for president, you get a travel advisory against Florida by the NAACP and a couple other interest groups as well, saying, oh, they've got policies that are hostile to this type of American or that type of American. Is this going to work? Let's start with Mike in Illinois. Mike, you're on WTMJ.
Good afternoon, Jeff. How are you?
Hi, Mike.
First of all, I have to say that I don't think the NAACP is an advocacy organization. I think they're a shakedown organization that gets money by, you know, trying to put pressure on governments and companies. I don't think this is going to hurt them too much. I think the only people that will probably try to adhere to this advisory or ban is the ultra-liberal whites. I don't even think the average black person will heed this. People are still going to go to Disney World. They're still going to go to Universal Studios, all the other touristy things that people do down in Florida. Mm-hmm. I think this is, as you said, nothing but political.
Thanks, Nicole. Well, you know, I can't imagine too many people saying, oh, okay, now, and look, let's understand what this was all about. This is not serious. This is about exactly what they're trying to do, get a headline in the paper the week before or the week that Ron DeSantis announces he's going to run for president, so you can, again, help your allies on the other side build this narrative that Ron DeSantis is this or Ron DeSantis is that. Candidly, as somebody who has a residence, has a place in Florida, I mean, I, if You know, you try going down to Southwest Florida in March when it's spring break and all the grandparents are bringing the kids down and stuff. It takes you forever to get places. So, I mean, if this is an idea and it ends up whether it's black or white or brown or green or blue people deciding, hey, maybe I'm going to stay away in March because the traffic's so great. Well, okay, you know, maybe that's even a plus. But in all seriousness, here, this is not a serious type of thing. And I can't believe that serious people are going to at least take this seriously in any regard. 855-616-1620. Jeff, a number of people are also making this point. The president of the NAACP lives in Florida, Tampa, I believe. How ironic is that? Yes, I think that that's the case as well. One of our texters suggests that, well, it's not going to hurt tourism. It's not going to hurt people traveling, but it might make persons of color or persons in the LGBTQ community make them more reluctant to move to Florida. Really? I mean, seriously. So if you have a job offer in Florida, you're not going to move down there because the NAACP suggests not to do it. If your goal has been to try to find a, let's say you're at a certain point in time, you're a person of color, and you know you're now ready to retire, and you're tired of long winters and the high crime rate in Chicago, and you can afford to move to Florida, you're not going to do it because the NAACP suggests, you know, otherwise. Don't think so. You know, and again, this is how these things just blow up big time, where you have these, and I'm going to describe the NAACP as an advocacy group. They're pushing for various issues, but you need to understand why stuff is happening and when stuff is happening. And that is because there's a lot of people who are very, very afraid that if Ron DeSantis gets into the race, and he is going to, and if Ron DeSantis is the Republican nominee for president, I think there's a decent chance that that could happen. I think there's some other people who will be interesting as well. But the concern is, if DeSantis is the nominee, he's going to win. So what we have to do is we have to do everything we possibly can to undermine that candidacy. And what better way than implying that, oh, Ron DeSantis is the governor of Florida, is some sort of evil, hateful racist. And how better could you do that than having the NAACP announced that, oh, we're issuing a travel advisory to Florida. It's all politics, pure and simple. It plays into the hands of some people that are out there trying to trash DeSantis. But just like efforts to undermine Georgia completely and totally failed, just like these efforts to, okay, we're going to issue bans on these types of things, almost always, or travel advisories, almost always fail because people see through them. This is the same situation. If anything, in a weird sort of way, just like when Donald Trump got charged criminally in New York and it helped his poll numbers go up, I wouldn't be surprised if in a backlash to some of this stuff, Ron DeSantis's poll numbers go up as well. If the NAACP is out to get him, you know, maybe that means that there's a reason why other people should look at him. Just saying. One of our texters gets it. Jeff, if Florida is such a hostile place for people of color to visit, why aren't they telling Florida residents to leave Florida? Well, that's an interesting point. Of course, the head of the NAACP lives in Florida, so that would be involved moving. But yeah, I mean, Florida, let's see, no state income tax. Well, you've got that. You've got, you know, a little bit hot in the summer, but you've got nice weather. Matter of fact, you know, if you look at where the migration is coming from, if you look at people who are pouring into Florida, they are coming from cities like, I don't know, New York. They're coming from cities like Chicago. They're coming from some of the big cities that have generally been run into the ground by liberal policies. And you have people who partly trying to, again, chase better economics, no state income tax and things like that, chase better weather. But also, I mean, we're trying to get away from high crime, high taxes, all these type of things. Yeah, that's why Florida continues to be one of the states in the country that is a magnet that is growing its population, while, like I say, a lot of these bigger cities, particularly the blue cities, they're seeing, you know, a mass exodus that is going on. But yeah, Let's warn people of color, or let's warn people from the LGBTQ community. Let's warn them about Florida. Well, I don't see any sort of migration coming from Florida, which is interesting. I made a reference just a little while ago to the down ballot drag, and one of the reasons why you're starting to see all this negative scrutiny of Ron DeSantis. And it's because, in many cases, both Democrats and the mainstream media, they don't want to see Ron DeSantis win, because if Ron DeSantis is the Republican nominee, as opposed to Donald Trump, they know that that's not good for Democrats, who are being supported by many people in the mainstream media and, of course, the Democratic Party. And, you know, the Washington Post just had a poll that demonstrates that. Okay, so they asked this question, and it was, are you more likely to vote for a Democrat for Congress if Trump is the nominee or if DeSantis is the nominee? And what happened was that if DeSantis is the nominee, Republicans win. And again, it's a generic sort of down ballot thing. They win 47-42. Trump, the question is much more up in the air. It's even, 44-44. There's no question that DeSantis is viewed as a much stronger candidate, and that's why there's this effort to undermine him. When we come back, one more story on national politics, actually two more stories on national politics today, but there's somebody who is also getting in the race this week that has the potential to change the dynamic. I'll explain, we'll discuss.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. Hopefully in the next couple days, we're going to make an exception to a general rule with the way I operate this program. If you're a regular listener, you know that I rarely have guests on. And there's a wide variety of reasons for that. And that's fine. I never tell other hosts, you know, how to do their shows. Just for my show, over the 25 years we've been doing this, I find that guests generally tend to slow down the show and serve kind of as a barrier between you and me when we're talking about things. But I do make exceptions from time to time. I made an exception several months ago leading into the elections last November, when I had the opportunity to have Republican Senator from South Carolina, Tim Scott, on the program. Tim Scott was coming into Wisconsin. He was going to attend. It was a rally, and he was with Ron Johnson. It was an event that was being held in Racine, and he was coming into town, and I had the opportunity to talk to him, and we did the interview, and then I had a chance that the next day, there was an event that I was invited to, and I had a chance to meet him. And as I think back on that interview, at one point in time, my wife said, Senator, my wife thinks, you know, you need to run for president. And he kind of like sort of deftly, you know, avoided that sort of question. Then we were at this event with Tim Scott, and I said, oh, you know, Senator, this is the lady I was talking to you about. And to this day, she sings the praises of Tim Scott. I bring this up because Tim Scott, Senator from South Carolina, has announced that he is going to be running for president. And I understand that immediately there are a number of people who are saying, oh, okay, who is Tim Scott? And don't you understand this is Donald Trump's race to win? And why are we even talking about these people? Well, we're talking about these people because this, in my opinion, is if Tim Scott were to gain traction, and I understand that that is an if, this is a game changer in American politics. And I'm willing to bet that many of you have no idea who Tim Scott really is, but it's one of the more compelling stories in American politics lately. Tim Scott, again, he's the senator. He was reelected to the U.S. Senate from South Carolina last November with 62% of the vote. He has, unlike a lot, he is, by the way, you know, he's black. Unlike a number of candidates who are getting into this race without any sort of wherewithal, Tim Scott has amassed a huge war chest. He's got like $20-30 million already, so he can be a player, just like Ron DeSantis can be a player. It takes money to run for president. But Tim Scott has an incredible, incredible background. He's the son of a single mom who was, you know, raised in South Carolina. His ancestors were slaves. You know, his ancestors, you know, were brought to South Carolina, and he was raised like that. His dad was a Vietnam veteran. His mom was a nurse who worked double shifts from 7 in the morning till 11 at night. His grandfather left school in the third grade to pick cotton for 50 cents a day. It's an incredible success story. As a freshman in high school, he failed English, Spanish, geography, and civics. His mom made him go to summer school and find a job to pay for it. It's just an amazing sort of story that is out there. So after he got out of college, he ended up selling insurance. He eventually grew this business into, like, he was selling Allstate insurance. He grew it into a 3,000 customer business. And then, you know, he got involved in politics. He was on the county council. Then he ran for, you know, state senate, got elected to the seat in the California state, in the California, South Carolina state house. Ultimately, what ended up happening is when Senator Jim DeMint, who was resigning, Nikki Haley, governor, appointed him to fill out the balance of DeMint's term. So he took over, won a special election, 61% of the vote, and then, like I say, was overwhelmingly, you know, reelected again when he ran for the rest of the term, and then was reelected with 62% of the vote. And he's really an interesting guy because he's what scares a lot of liberals. He is a black conservative. He says, look, I don't believe America is a racist country. He says, look at what I was able to accomplish. It might be challenging, but he rejects that notion that's out there. And he points to his own success story that is there. He's conservative. He is a pro-life candidate, but at the same time, he also, I think, has a reasonable approach to this. He criticizes what he believes is the victim mentality that exists in American culture. He is very critical of the left for using racial issues, he argues, as a means of further dividing the electorate. In any event, he's got an incredibly compelling backstory, and he's got an incredibly compelling message. One other thing, he's 57 years old. So, I mean, heaven forbid we have somebody who is running for president who isn't in his upper 70s or in his 80s. He's 57 years old, again, with this compelling backstory. Now, look, I don't know. I don't know if he can gain traction. I don't. I will tell you, though, that this is, in my opinion, one of the most interesting candidates to come down the road in a long, long time. And part of it is because of this backstory. It's somebody who came from very, very limited means, who has not been a career politician, who built a business, and who understands the challenges that you have. And if you ever have an opportunity to hear him speak in person, he's soft-spoken, he's unassuming. I think that would be a fair word to use to describe him. And he is, at least in my opinion, he's extremely personable and he's extremely likable. And I don't know how this all plays out, but I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to see somebody like Tim Scott getting involved in politics, because in my opinion, he is exactly the type of person that we need to see in politics. And I'm so thrilled that there's going to be other choices that are out there. That's one of the reasons that one of the missions of my producer, Charlie, is going to be to kind of track him down and see, you know, if we can get him on in the next couple of days, because I enjoyed our conversation several months ago. Right now, our number is 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. And here's the approach, whether it's Tim Scott or Nikki Haley or somebody else. Aren't you glad to see alternatives that are starting to emerge to Donald Trump and to Joe Biden? And maybe Tim Scott isn't your cup of tea. Okay, I get it. But isn't it nice to have alternatives? And isn't it nice to have alternatives that, you know, like I say, aren't 78 and 80 and 82 and 86 if they complete their term? Isn't it nice to have alternatives and choices? And are we open to that as we move into the 2024 election cycle? And my answer is yes. And I hope people are willing to take a look at some of these candidates that are, in fact, emerging. 855-616-1620. Let's talk about it. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. Jeff, I love Tim Scott. He gave an amazing rebuttal when President Biden was elected. Yeah, that was the response to the Biden State of the Union address back in 2021. Jeff, Tim Scott knows what it's like to be average. Yeah, that's it. Jeff, I will not vote for either Biden or Trump in the next election. I'm thankful for alternatives as long as we don't have 15 people running against Trump, which would just split the vote. The Republican Party needs good options. For those of you not familiar with Tim Scott, let me, I gave you the guy's background, which I think is so compelling. And one of the things that is so interesting is that he rejects the racial narrative you get from so many people, but at the same time, you know, recognizing this. He says he's been stopped by a Capitol police officer on his way into the Capitol to vote five times. Each time, after showing the officer my credentials, I'm detained. Each time, I've had to ask my white colleagues to tell the officer who I was. He says, nowadays, whenever I hear about the black experience, the only stories I hear are the hard stories. And while I believe these stories are important to tell, if you listen to the national narrative, you would think that each and every one of us has lived a life of desperate pain, heartache, and misery. You would think black people across our great nations are victims of pretty much everything. What a ridiculous way to view the world. He says, people are fixated on my color. I'm just not. I'm just not. Jeff, he writes, when I look at our nation, I don't see division. I don't for one second believe the false narrative of a racist, divided America that has been spun by big media. He says, injustice is real, but infinitely more real is opportunity. He says, there are two ways to view history. One is to shine an unwavering light on the myriad of atrocities that have befallen us. He's talking about persons of color. And there is nothing wrong with having a realistic and honest accounting of history. In fact, it's vital that we do so. It helps us to keep from repeating it. From my experience, however, dwelling on the pain of the past for too long threatens to keep us mired there. When I look back, I prefer to focus on how far we've come. Only then can I envision how beautiful the road ahead could be. Huh. You know, isn't that interesting that you have that approach? And he's been touring the country articulating this. And of course, the response from the American left has been to label him as an Uncle Tom. If you remember, like I said, he gave the rebuttal to Biden's State of the Union address in April of 2021. And the big trending thing on Twitter then was Uncle Tim. That was the way he was derisively referred to. How dare you have a conservative black man come and express this stuff? And here's his response to that. He says, for those of you on the left, you can call me a prop, you can call me a token, you can call me the N-word, you can question my blackness, you can even call me Uncle Tim. Just understand, your words are no match for my evidence. Your pessimism is no match for my history. My existence shows your irrelevance. The truth of my life disproves your lies. All I am saying is, for those of you who are out there who are frustrated with the status quo and frustrated with the choices, and I hear from you all the time, oh my God, I can't believe 2024 is going to be Biden and Trump again. My head wants to explode. Believe me, I know where you're coming from. All I am telling you is that there are compelling alternatives that are out there. Maybe it's Ron DeSantis from Florida, but maybe, just maybe, it's Tim Scott who's getting into the race today. And if you haven't heard about him, all right, he's somebody you might want to pay attention to, because, like I say, I think he's the real deal, and I think he offers a perspective that we're missing and have been missing for a while in American politics. Did I mention he's in his mid-50s, for goodness sakes? Somebody running for office who's not 75 or 80 or 85 years old when they wrap up their term. Oh, what a surprise that is. We'll be right back. Here is a classic example of why you can never save the taxpayers' money. Because when government officials get a chance to spend money, they will spend it. I mean, one of the things that's going on with the debt limit discussions, one of the things the Republicans are trying to do, because spending is out of control, they're saying, all right, this money that we set aside for the COVID emergency, the money that we set aside, well, now that the emergency's over, this money that hasn't been spent, let's just use it to reduce spending. All right, it was supposed to be spent during the emergency, hasn't been spent, so let's just keep it. All right, and they're getting all sorts of blowback. Well, how dare you? You know, we decided to spend this during an emergency. It wasn't needed to be spent during the emergency, so how dare we not spend it? And Republicans are saying, look, this is the low-hanging fruit. This is money. The pandemic is over. You know, we don't need emergency spending anymore. Let's at least save this. And they're getting huge blowback. You're seeing a story about that locally. Now, the latest huge white elephant that we have committed tens of millions of dollars to around here is this not really so high-speed bus rapid transit line, which will run from the lakefront essentially out to the Medical College of Wisconsin at a cost of 50-some million dollars. We've already talked about how it's going to, if you ride the entire route, it shaves like 8 minutes off the entire trip. But that's only if you ride the entire route. And what we've had is we've now eliminated various city street lanes on various streets to commit them to this not-so-high-speed bus. And the estimates are this is going to increase bus ridership dramatically. And the same people that are making those estimates are probably the same ones who talked about all the people that would be paying money to ride the hop. And that hasn't turned out. But here's the deal. Apparently, the Federal Transit Administration has come through with a $2.1 million grant through the American Rescue Plan Act. This is, again, the COVID money. And it's designed to reduce the local cost of the project, right? It's federal money, which is supposed to make the installation of this cheaper. Well, here's the deal. Apparently, the people that put this all together, they've already borrowed to, you know, build the bus lines and stuff. So now you've got $2.1 million that's coming in. You would think that you would take that $2.1 million and use it to reduce the debt that we have on the project, right? That's what, like, normal people would do. Hey, all of a sudden, you know, this was designed for this. I've got this extra $2 million that's now come in. Great. You know, we can pay off some of the bonding. We can pay off some of the debt. But this is government. What they have decided to do is, instead of, since they've already, again, gone into debt for the cost of the project, now you get this $2.1 million that's coming in, instead of using it to pay down the debt, what they've decided to do is to spend it. So they're going to take this $2.1 million and build a site on this vacant lot that they're going to try to turn into the Vell Phillips Plaza right next door to where I'm sitting right now. And they're going to try to increase amenities at some of the other places. So instead of using this extra money to do what I think would be responsible and say, okay, well, that's fine, let's reduce the overall cost of the project. No, we've got this extra money in here. Let's go out and let's spend it. And this is why you never get control on government spending, because unlike in the real world, where if, hey, suddenly, you know, you've taken out a home loan, and then all of a sudden you get some extra money that was designed to reduce the cost of the home in the first place. Most people would use it to, again, if you were being responsible, to pay down the cost of the loan. That's not what we do in government. Hey, this is free money. Let's spend it and buy even more stuff. And that is precisely what they are doing with this bus line, adding to the cost of it. Go figure. I fully recognize that I am swimming upstream when it comes to this issue, because we're in the situation where we're in a situation where everybody, the argument when it comes to legalizing marijuana is that people do it anyways. It's not as bad, or it's certainly no worse than alcohol. So let's just go ahead and do it. And I mean, I've tried to raise some of the practical concerns about this. Like, for example, do you want the guy that's driving the Zoom-o-bile, who's going to be hauling your kids around on school buses or whatever? Do you want him to be, you know, high on marijuana or to have been smoking dope on his way into work, et cetera, et cetera? And most people say, well, no, I don't think that's a good idea. Do you want the guy that's up on the roof, or laying bricks, or, you know, doing construction work or whatever? Do you want that person to have, I don't know, spent the morning or his lunch hour smoking pot and then coming into the job site? And the argument I get is, well, no, that's not a very good idea. We agree with that. But the problem is, you know, we don't want him drinking either. Well, the issue, though, is how do you tell if they are impaired on marijuana? And there was a story in the New York Times. And I know it pained the New York Times to write this story, but marijuana has been decriminalized in New York State. And so here's the headline of the story that caught my attention. Why it's so hard to crack down on stoned drivers in New York. Smoking marijuana while driving appears to have become ubiquitous in New York City after the drug's legalization. It's a trend, though, that though illegal, is not easy to curb. And so the premise of the story is, okay, you're not allowed, you're allowed to get yourself high, but you're not allowed to operate a car, a vehicle, under the influence of marijuana. The problem is that unlike with drinking and driving, where there are very, very clear defined standard. You take a blood alcohol test, right? And the blood alcohol tests, if you test 0.08 or above, there is a presumption that, you know, that in and of itself is against the law. Now, you can be convicted of driving while impaired if you have a lower blood alcohol level, but then they have to prove other things. But there's a pretty much of a standard. You know, 0.08, boom. You know, your blood alcohol is above that. You're guilty of, you know, driving while under the influence. Well, the problem is, let me give you an idea. In New York City, a city of 8.5 million residents, 2 million cars, 36,000 police officers, police officials say they arrested blank number of people last year for driving under the influence of marijuana. Okay, so just think about a number. 8.5 million people, 36,000 police officers. How many people do you think got arrested for driving under the influence? 10,000? 5,000? 1,000? 500? Nope. 204 people. In comparison to over 3,300 arrests last year for drinking and driving. And what law enforcement is saying is, look, here's the problem. They're scratching the surface, because the problem is, in order to crack down on driving high, you have, it's very, very difficult to do. There's not a breathalyzer type of device for evaluating blood marijuana levels. Difficulty to prove impairment, legal limitations when apprehending stoned drivers, unlike, you know, what happens when you have alcohol. Then they tell this story. It's they say, you know, they set up and they're watching people hanging outside a smoke shop in Morningside Heights. They watch customers smoke their purchases at store counters and then hop into their cars outside and drive off. Younger drivers are more likely to smoke pot and drive and to be involved in many hundreds of fatal accidents a year statewide that authorities say are connected to drug use. So what you have here is, all right, we've legalized marijuana. Boom. That's fine. More people, more and more people are smoking. They're smoking marijuana while they are driving. And in New York, and probably in Wisconsin as well, the fact that you can't just pull them over. You have to have a reason for pulling them over in the first place. But the problems of proof are overwhelming. So, again, I understand. Whenever we talk about this, I am swimming upstream and saying, hey, maybe we should go slow on this whole idea of legalizing marijuana. But from the perspective of safety on the roadways, there is a real concern with how you apprehend people and prosecute people for driving while impaired on, in this case, on marijuana. So is that 855-616-1620, that's the old National Bank talk and text line, is that a justification for going slow on legalizing pot, or should we just say, what do we care? You know, we've got reckless drivers that are going around, we've got drunk drivers going around, so what do we care if we've got more people driving when they're high? One guy in the New York Times story actually says, I drive better when I'm stoned because I focus more, man. Yeah, that's right. I'm sure you think you drive better when you're stoned. But there is that kind of attitude that's out there. So 855-616-1620. Until we get a better handle on how you prosecute people for driving while high, is that a reason to kind of go slow on the whole legalization process? 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. If you're just tuning in, New York Times, liberal publication, okay, has a big story over the weekend talking about how since New York State legalized marijuana, they have a huge problem that's developed because you have all these people that are driving high. And unlike with alcohol, where there's a baseline, blood alcohol level 0.08 or above, boom, then you get arrested for operating an influence. There's no baseline when it comes to marijuana. And so you have, it's not like there's some sort of standard test that detects the marijuana level in your bloodstream and things like that. So they're effectively, for all intents and purposes, except in extreme cases, unable to prosecute people for driving while high. And it's creating huge problems. And I think you can take that one more step and say, this is going to be a huge problem for people in the workplace as well, which is, okay, how do you prove that somebody is impaired? And if you try to have like a zero tolerance policy, as we've talked about before, problem is that marijuana stays in your system for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. You know, how do you deal with this? But I mean, I, for one, the last thing you need is more people driving impaired on the roadways, but unable to be prosecuted because the standards don't exist. And you sure, from a workplace perspective, don't need more people coming in, you know, high, and then going up on roofs or driving the Zoom-mobile or whatever. 855-616-1620. Jeff, I agree. I've been saying this from the start. Until they have a test or some sort of baseline for drivers or people operating heavy equipment to know if they are under the influence of marijuana, I don't believe we should be legalizing it. It just opens up another whole can of worms to add to the problems we already have with drunk driving and reckless driving. Mary in Brookfield. Mary, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff, you are right on. I agree with you. We don't have a baseline, and those people are irresponsible. They text and they drive. There's no baseline. Go to Mayfair Mall, and that stinks like a skunk outside in the parking lot. And then, look it, we can't smoke regular cigarettes in public in the bars and stadium. Why should we be tolerating that stuff? What about people like me with severe asthma?
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I do. Thanks. I mean, and again, I understand that there is this irony that many of the people who talk about like cigarettes and their carcinogenic effects, you know, are the same ones who are saying, well, OK, you know, marijuana, which is a lot more carcinogenic, that's no problem there. But again, that's an individual choice that's made. This is more of a societal one. Now, here's an interesting text. Jeff, this argument has been made by every state before legalization. After legalization, it never became a problem. Why do you think Wisconsin drivers are going to be different? No, that's the whole point of this conversation. Big story in the New York Times. It is a problem in New York. That New York State, that's it. They're not able to arrest people. That's what the cops are saying. They believe that, for example, marijuana has been responsible for hundreds and hundreds of drug-related accidents, particularly among young people who are more inclined to smoke pot and then drive. They're saying it's a huge problem, but they're not able to prosecute hardly anybody because there is no baseline for this. So, yeah, and I think my guess is that, you know, you would, if you were being honest, you would find the same problem in all the other states over time that ended up doing this. Now, I understand that that's not for the people that just want to go along with this. Here, let's do this because, well, you know, pot is no worse than alcohol, etc. I'm not even having that argument. I'm just saying there's not a measurement now that you can prosecute people for driving while high as a general rule. And so what we're doing is we're making it easier for people to drive while they're impaired on the roadways. Is that good? Is that a positive thing that's out there? And so, and I understand that there are people like the potheads of the world that don't care. Oh, so somebody's driving along, they've had a couple joints, you know, it's just going to mellow them out. Okay, that's fine until they mellow them out, they run through the red light, and they hit and crash into somebody's car and kill four people on their way to church. Okay, that's fine. I'm just saying that there's enough of that stuff that happens as it is. I mean, there's enough reckless driving out there. There's enough intoxicated on alcohol driving that's out there. And I really do wonder where, you know, organizations like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, where these groups are on this particular issue. Is it because, well, it's just politically incorrect to oppose legalization of marijuana? So, you know, we're not going to kind of fight this battle. I just raise this issue because before we do these various things, you think you have to think it through. And okay, what is the social consequence going to be for this? Forget for a moment about, you know, whether, you know, continual marijuana use, you know, kills initiative and drive, and, you know, you end up living in your mother's basement till you're 42 years old and digging hash brownie out of your ears. Forget about that whole thing. But ask yourself the question, if you agree with my premise, and I don't think it's arguable, that if you legalize marijuana, more people will smoke it and they will do it, and they will do it on a more regular basis. Then if you accept that, my only point is, don't you have to have some baseline standard as part of the law, which defines how you're going to define people who are driving while intoxicated? Don't you have to have some sort of standard for employers, which are going to determine, okay, at what level are we going to let people come in and work heavy machinery and do those type of things? Again, we're getting some texts that are saying, well, alcohol is worse. I'm not defending alcohol use at all. I think it is a scourge, and I'm just death on drunk driving. So that's not the point. And am I arguing that you take one hit of marijuana and that means that you're impaired to drive? No. But the point is, you know, there's no standard measurement, unlike with alcohol, for how much marijuana you can have and then be impaired. And until you get that standard to just legalize smoking dope and driving at the same time with no way to enforce this as a practical matter, I think it's bad public policy, period. And you know what? New York is starting to find that out as we speak. One of our texters is saying, well, okay, that might be the New York experience, but what about Colorado? Let's talk about Colorado. All right, let's talk about Colorado, which is one of the first states to legalize marijuana. Let me just give you some of the numbers. I just pulled this up quickly. This is Mothers Against Drunk Driving. The percentage of all Colorado traffic deaths that were marijuana-related increased from 11.4% in 2013 to 21.3% in 2017. Consistent with the past, in 2017, less than half of the drivers, 42%, or half of the operators, 50%, involved in traffic deaths were tested for drug impairment. Again, it's because it's so difficult to determine, you know, whether or not somebody's high, and there aren't good baselines. Denver Post, this is what they say. How bad has high driving gotten in Colorado? In a recent large-scale study, researchers have found the number of driving deaths involving marijuana-intoxicated drivers has skyrocketed in recent years. In Colorado alone, the number of fatal crashes from 2013 to 2016 rose by 40% to 880. Now, those years are a couple, those numbers are a couple years older, but it's, look, there's no doubt that the number of traffic fatalities have increased dramatically since marijuana was legalized. And people can pretend it's not a problem. Oh, okay, I understand all that. You can pretend it's not a problem because it fits your agenda. I wanna be able to legally smoke pot. Okay, I get it. That's fine. But let's also recognize that there are social costs on the other side. And you can't ignore that reality. And New York is just the latest state dealing with this problem. And my guess is the numbers in Colorado, and that's what these studies suggest, they're probably a lot more. They're probably a lot greater because there's a lot of fatalities. There's a lot of traffic collisions where they don't even test for marijuana because, again, no good basis. It's not like alcohol. So am I arguing that driving high is worse than driving drunk? No. But I'm arguing it's a lot easier to get away with driving high than it is to get away with driving drunk. And why in God's green earth would we want to give more excuses for people to get impaired and be on the roads? Just asking. When we come back, it is a controversy involving a common phrase. I will explain and we will discuss.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. So, Wyatt, in the last segment, we were talking about marijuana use and problems they're having in New York with people who are driving high, but they can't prosecute them because there's no good standard test on all this. So that was one of our texters asked me the question about, Jeff, when you were in Amsterdam a couple of years ago, did you notice an issue with like marijuana? And have you ever been to Amsterdam?
I have been to Amsterdam for exactly 24 hours before I had to flee the Netherlands to return to London and then the United States because it was the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, we were, our crew, we've done a number of listener cruises over the last couple of years. We got one more that we're going to announce relatively soon. But when we did the Rhine cruise, it started in Amsterdam. So we were there for a couple of days. And I love Amsterdam. I mean, it's got a ton of history that's there, and you've got the Anne Frank House, and you've got the
I love the Van Gogh Museum.
The Van Gogh Museum, right, that you could spend a lot of time there. But, you know, it is, you walk around the streets of Amsterdam, and it reminds me of going to a rock concert in 1974. I mean, that the scent of marijuana is just overpowering in all sorts of places. But that's not where the story goes. So we're wandering around with people from the cruise, including some friends of ours, you know, dear friends of ours, Betty and Peter. And outside of our hotel in Amsterdam, they have all sorts of storefronts that sell like food and stuff. And their first day we walk by and there's this place that sells French fries, and it's just like a storefront. And the line, there must have been 60 or 70 people in this line. And we walk by and we go, damn, these must be really, really good French fries that people are standing in line to see this. And so my friend Peter and I, we start talking about this. You know, maybe this is something, maybe we should find out who owns this place and see if there's like this recipe or something. And maybe we could bring whatever they're selling at this French fry stand. Maybe we could figure out a way to bring it to Milwaukee and make some money out of it. So we're thinking about business opportunities. So, and my wife, she's not saying anything. She's kind of shaking her head. So the next night, we're walking past. Now it's raining. I mean, not pouring rain, but it's raining. It's a kind of an icky night. We're walking, and the line is double. I mean, there's like 120 people in line at this French fry place. And I say, I got to figure this out because, you know, there's not too much stuff that I'm going to wait in line in the rain for. But okay, these must be like great French fries. And they're French fries, and you get your choices of like 15 different toppings, like mayonnaise and stuff. So my friend Betty and I, my wife and Peter, they're undercover. We stand in line waiting for the French fries. So finally, you know, 10 minutes go by, we get there, we order our French fries, we go back, meet our respective spouses who are undercover now, dry, looking at us, and we got the French fries, and we try the French fries, and they're okay. I mean, they're French fries. They're nothing special.
Yeah, you can get it in the market hall.
You can get them, right. I mean, they're like, eh, nothing special. And I'm going, I just don't get this. And then, of course, my wife cutting through all the you-know-what says, they're all high, Jeff. Don't you understand that? It's just everybody's got the munchies. That's why. And this the French fries, that's it. So
yeah, if you operate a potato chip store in Amsterdam, you got to be making bank.
Well, exactly. That's it. It's like, okay, unless and until they legalize, you know, marijuana in downtown Milwaukee, I'm not running the French fry stand. But once they do. I was thinking these are going to be like the best French fries I've ever had in my life, and then they were only okay. But yeah. I wasn't
dispensary
high.
Right here, right. Jeff's French fry stand right next door.
Absolutely. Now that is the idea, or maybe right, maybe Jeff's dispensary and then Jeff's French fry stand, huh?
You're diversifying your portfolio.
Well, absolutely. You got them both covered. So you go into Jeff's smoke shop, you know, you get yourself all worked up, and then you stand on. But again, it was my wife Fran. She said, these aren't anything special. They're all high, stupid. You know, it's just like, this is the perfect thing for everybody that's high. So there are these business opportunities that are out there. It just took me a while to grasp it. But
see, I talked about this on Wisconsin's Afternoon News once, but I actually cannot smell. I have no sense of smell and never have as long as I can remember. So when I was in Amsterdam, I feel like I didn't get the full experience. I did not smell anything there.
Oh, no. It's just, and you walk in downtown Amsterdam. I'm not talking about you go into the smoke shop. And interestingly, the cafes, if you go in to have like a beer and stuff, they're not allowed to sell. The smoke shops are exclusive. You can't go and drink and have beer and smoke pot at the same time. It's different things. But it's like a lot of big cities in Europe, it's very, very crowded. And so you have like these narrow alleyways and stuff. So lots of people kind of on top of each other. But yeah, you walk down the streets and trust me, I know you weren't going to rock concerts in 1975, but trust me, it's like going to a rock concert in 1975. You go, wow. First of all, I remember that smell. Oh, yes, I remember that smell from back in the day. So you know, it just kind of comes with the territory. But this is my note. If they ever get ready to legalize recreational marijuana in Wisconsin, that's it. You got to be thinking outside the box. And that's when I go talk to this guy in Amsterdam and see if I can get like the recipe for all the different French fries, because it was blockbuster back then. I'm not sure that they were anything special, but of course I hadn't been smoking weed. All right. Here's a fun topic I wish to discuss with you. A lot of times, my lovely wife will say, okay, what do you want for dinner? You know, what can I make you for dinner? Isn't it nice you got a wife that, you know, wants to make you dinner and stuff like that? And I sometimes struggle with, okay, what are we going to have? But many, many times, if it is a particular day of the week, it makes it easy. Because I will say, hey, it's Taco Tuesday, right? Now, you have heard that phrase before, right? Because my guess is that many, 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 many of you have gone out for tacos on Tuesday night, right? It's just the ubiquitous thing. It's Taco Tuesday. When I was in law school, it goes back that far, there was a bar that had a kitchen in downtown Milwaukee. And they had Taco Tuesdays. That was the big deal. And they had taco specials. And things alike. And we regularly went out for Taco Tuesdays at this particular bar that is long since gone. Restaurants all over have Taco Tuesdays, right? It's almost a ubiquitous thing. Hey, let's go out for tacos on Tuesday night. We hear this. Did you know that there is an outfit that claims that no other restaurants should be able to market the term Taco Tuesday? Who owns the phrase Taco Tuesday? Well, according to the government's patent office, the answer is Taco John's. You ever heard of Taco John's? I'm not sure if they have any Taco John's around here. Do they have a Taco John's around here?
Yeah, there is one in West Allis on National, and there's another one like West Milwaukee. Or
okay,
Milwaukee.
So it's a Midwestern chain. It's based out of Wyoming, but you know it's based out of Wyoming, Taco John's, but. Charlie's going to fact check me on this one. No, I'm right about that. It's a fast food chain based in Wyoming. And apparently what happened is back in 1989, they went to the patent office
and they claimed the trademark rights to Taco Tuesday. Well, now there's a lawsuit because Taco Bell is suing, and they're saying, look, this is, you cannot, Taco Tuesday is ubiquitous, and you have bars and restaurants and places all over the country, all over the world perhaps, that are using the phrase Taco Tuesday, and we should be free to run advertising saying, hey, it's Taco Tuesday, come to Taco Bell. Mexican restaurants should be free to say, hey, it's Taco Tuesday, come to, you know, Jeff and Charlie's Mexican restaurant. Not that we'd set up a Mexican restaurant, but you get the idea. So Taco John's claims to have invented the phrase, despite the fact that there's all sorts of evidence that, you know, people and places before they filed the trademark back in 1989 claimed it. But they say, hey, we've got the exclusive rights to it. And here's the deal. If Taco Bell decides to challenge, if they decide that they want to use the phrase, hey, it's Taco Tuesday, make a run for the border or whatever, we're going to sue them. We coined the phrase. It's a mainstay. And we're going to use that phrase, and we're going to protect our rights if other people choose to use the phrase Taco Tuesday. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Every once in a while, stuff kind of passes into sort of the general public domain. So here is my question. Taco John, an outfit that maybe you've heard of it. I mean, I have, because where I went to college, that's if you wanted to go out for, they didn't have Taco Bell's there. They had Taco John's. So if Taco John says, we have the trademark to Taco Tuesday, and other places are not allowed to use it, 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. What do you think? Should Jeff and Charlie's restaurant be able to say, hey, it's Taco Tuesday, come on over, we're running our special? Or that should that be something that is exclusively within the purview of this Wyoming-based fast food restaurant that apparently has one or two locations in Wisconsin, or at least around here? 855-616-1620. I say, I'm with Taco Bell, free Taco Tuesday. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620. Jeff, my friend owns a bar restaurant, received a cease and desist letter from Taco John's a few years ago telling them to stop using the phrase Taco Tuesday. She changed the marquee to a day formerly known as Taco Tuesday. Should you be able to trademark Taco Tuesday? Now, interestingly, Taco John's holds the trademark for that in 49 states. In New Jersey, there is a bar restaurant, Gregory's Restaurant and Bar, that patented the phrase in New Jersey in 1979. So if the phrase Taco Tuesday belongs to Taco John's everywhere in the country except New Jersey, where it belongs to this Gregory's Restaurant and Bar, I don't think it should belong to anybody. I think Taco Tuesday has become ubiquitous. And you know, if places want to run specials on Tuesday, to me, and a number of you are making this point on our text line, you know, what if somebody goes out and tries to trademark the phrase Friday Fish Fry? You know, could you do that? You know, if we've got a really, you know, kick butt fish fry and we want to go out and we want to trademark the phrase Friday Fish Fry, should we be able to do that? I think that is very similar to trying to claim Taco Tuesday. Rome in Oconomowoc. Rome, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Jeff.
Sure.
I was in grad school in 1989-90 in La Crosse, at UW La Crosse. And every Tuesday, the local Taco John's in La Crosse would sponsor the Taco Tuesday, where you could get a six pack of tacos and a pound of potatoes.
Exactly. So this
potato Olay.
Yeah. So it's been no. Thanks for calling. No, but it's been around for a while. Like I say, I mean, I can remember. Okay, so when I'm there was a bar. It's not there anymore, but that was the big thing. It was Taco Tuesdays. And, I mean, it was before I was really aware of, I, I, quite candidly, until I saw this story over the weekend, I had no clue that Taco John's had trademarked the phrase Taco Tuesday. I just thought it was kind of one of those terms that it was out in the public domain because so many places have Taco Tuesdays, don't they? Let's talk to Gianni in Montello. Gianni, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Yes, Jeff. Interesting topic. Hey, listen. Two words. What is the patent office doing issuing a patent on Taco Tuesday? It seems ridiculous. You cannot patent. I wouldn't think, but in this crazy government and world that we live in, that would be issued. But this is not intellectual property. This is not a song or a melody. This is not a poem. This is not a movie, a film, an invention that makes our lives better. What is the patent office doing issuing a patent on
That involves a day of the week. Yeah, no, right. Thanks for calling. No, I'm with you. That involves like a day of the week. If I wanted to, I don't know, Sunshine Wednesday or whatever, I agree with you. I think this is a bizarre sort of thing. But regardless, it's become, again, this sort of ubiquitous phrase that's out there. Now, the way this is coming out is that Taco John's, like I was reading with one of our texts, Taco John's has gone after small business operators in an effort to enforced this over the years. Now Taco Bell is suing them, seeking to, the phrase is, you know, liberate everybody. So Taco Bell isn't saying that we should be able to use this exclusively, but Taco Bell is saying that there should be no controls on this. And if, you know, Jeff and Charlie's bar decides that they want to, you know, run Taco Tuesday, they should be able to advertise it, and Taco Bell should be able to advertise, hey, it's Taco Tuesday, come in for our special, and Taco John's should not have a special limitation on it. I think that there is an appeal to that. Jeff, Taco Tuesday is generic, just kind of like light beer. Well, I think that there's an element of this. I don't know how this is all going to turn out, but if you are thinking about, I don't know, bringing people over for, hey, meals, or your spouse asks you, what do you want for dinner? And you say, hey, it's Taco Tuesday. Be careful. Taco John's may be coming for you. A number of you are entrepreneurs. I'm being swamped with different suggestions of things. If you can trademark, you know, Taco Tuesday, can't you trademark like Friday fish fries? How about Sunday fun day? That's a number of people suggesting I should be able to trademark Sunday fun day. Look, the bottom line of all this is I appreciate there's this thing that in the law they call intellectual property and these ideas that people have come up with and they deserve to be protected and you can't have people that come in and exploit them. I'm sympathetic to all that, but Taco Tuesday is Taco Tuesday. The term is ubiquitous, and if Taco John's is out there trying to tell small businesses that they can't say, hey, we're running a Taco Tuesday special, I think it's time for them to be legally slapped down. That's just me. Over the weekend, Brittany Griner, you know, the WNBA basketball player who spent 10 months detained in Russia on what I argue is bogus charges. I mean, she had a very, very small quantity of hashish oil that under normal circumstances would have resulted in her being fined or fined and deported. But because she got caught with this 3 days before Russia got ready to invade Ukraine, she was grabbed and held as a political prisoner. That's just the reality. And ultimately, she was exchanged for an arms dealer known as the Merchant of Death, which has resulted in, you know, we've been talking about this before. Last week we did a topic about how there's even more American athletes that are going to Russia and playing. And I guess my response is, at this point in time, you go over there, you're assuming the risk. And if you get grabbed on some bogus charge, don't expect the government to be trading another arms dealer for you. But anyhow, Brittany Griner made her WNBA first appearance, over the weekend. And it's interesting because her coach was sort of upset. They thought that there was going to be a sellout. It was in L.A. And it was only half full. They drew about 10,000 people. The stadium fit 19. And the coach was upset. Where are all these people? And I think there's a couple things going on. First of all, I think there's still a lot of people who are unhappy with, you know, the fact that Brittany Griner did what she did, and we had to exchange the Merchant of Death arms dealer for her. And then the other reflection is, even if you're glad to have her back, and I'm glad to have her back, at the same time, you know, the WNBA, and these are amazing players, there's no question about it, but women's basketball just still isn't at the level from attendance perspective of where men's basketball is. So I don't know there was anything surprising about it, and I don't know that the fans should be shamed for this. Actually, I think, you know, having the arena half full was probably a pretty good, you know, indicator, and it shows there's some support, because I'm not sure 2 years ago if they would have had enough people there for that. But anyhow, Brittany Griner is back, and she is playing. We'll see how the season works out. So very glad to have you with us. Once again, we, in addition to spoken word radio, and you can connect with us via terrestrial radio, the typical over-the-air stuff, or through streaming, and you can stream us through WTMJ Live, our app. There's also the podcast, so you can timeshare. We are now, we broadcast on the stream. We have cameras in the studio, and you can watch what we do every day live streaming. You simply go to WTMJ.com, click on the Watch Live button, and you can see how we look on a daily basis, if that's what you're interested in. You can also subscribe to us. We've got our own YouTube channel. Who knew? We're going to talk more about this next story tomorrow, but the police chief and the district attorney have announced today charges against a violent group of individuals. The story is that they have identified 90-plus individuals who they believe have been responsible for 100-plus shootings in Milwaukee over the last several years. 100-plus shootings, 25 homicides in the last 3 years that they say are all related to a number of loosely organized street gangs. 90-plus men have been arrested. Some are already serving time. Once more details on that emerge, it will be interesting to see, because there's no question in my mind that a lot of the violence that has been going on in this community over the last several years has been the responsibility of, I would say, a relatively limited group of people. And that's what's been so frustrating about, you look at the violence levels, because yes, there are always going to be random shootings. That's just the reality. And then there's going to be the crimes of passion. And then there's going to be the road rage thing where somebody gets upset and pulls out a gun. But when you look at a lot of the organized criminal activity, what you find is it's being undertaken by people who are members of street gangs, et cetera, and that fuels a lot of it, whether it's the armed robberies, whether it's the car thefts, et cetera, and then carjackings, you name it. And a lot of that comes from, again, people who are, you know, part of this various gang mentality. So if we're doing something to finally get these people off the street, I am 110%, you know, behind it. You just saw the federal indictment in the last week or so of a number of members of street gangs who were involved in guns and were involved in defrauding the federal government and things like that. That's what we need to, and we should have been doing much more of. So more on that tomorrow once more details emerge, but that's what they announced. Okay, if you are a regular listener of this program, you know, apart from policy, I am very troubled by the fact that we do not seem to have a young generation of leaders. You know, Joe Biden, who apparently will be the Democrat nominee for president, he's going to be 82 when he runs for reelection. And I was watching some news clips of him on TV yesterday involving coming back from the G7 meetings. And look, put politics aside, he's struggling. I mean, again, I don't care if you're liberal or conservative or moderate or whatever. He's 80 and he looks every day of 80. Okay, maybe he looks 78, but he's clearly showing the signs of age. And there's no surprise. He's you know, 80 years old. You've got Donald Trump would be like 78, you know, next year if he were to win the presidency. And as I was saying in the segment we were talking earlier about Tim Scott, why can't we find younger leaders? There was a story in the New York Times that really got me thinking. Dianne Feinstein, who, of course, she's the senator from California who's been absent for a huge chunk of time, and just absolutely refuses to leave. She's 89 years old. She's announced her retirement, but not until 2025. You know, she intends to assuming she lives and survives the balance of her term, she says that she's going to serve her term. She's not going to leave. And maybe you saw the picture. She was out of Washington for several weeks with severe health problems. You know, they brought her back, and she's in a wheelchair. The reports are that she's very, very forgetful, that this last illness was very severe. But even at the age of 89, independently wealthy, so, yeah, the perks of office are nice, but she can do whatever she wants. She refuses to give it up before her term ends in 2025, even though everybody understands that she suffers from substantial memory issues and struggles to do the job because of complications from illness. And the New York Times, it goes on to list some of these other ones. It talks about, you know, Strom Thurmond, South Carolina Republican, hung on till he was over 100. Robert Byrd, Democrat from West Virginia, died in office at age of 92 after 51 years in the Senate. And it goes on and on and on. And it talks about how one politician after another just can't walk away. It just cannot give it up. And I'm always struck by this because at some point in time, we all age out of things. Athletes, you know, you start, I don't care if you're a great baseball player or a great football player or a great basketball player or a hockey player or whatever, there is going to be a point in time when you age out, where you cannot compete anymore because maybe it's injuries, your skills are going to atrophy, whatever. That's going to be the reality. In business, whether it's as the CEO of publicly held companies or law firms or whatever, there's typically an up or out thing. At the age, there's typically an out thing. 65 years old, 68 years old, certainly by 70, at most corporations, at most companies, particularly most publicly traded companies, the expectation is you're going to move on. You're going to be gone. You have to be retired, and then we're going to have this new generation that's in there. But in politics, as long as you can raise the money, scare off opponents, and get reelected, you get to stay. And the story in the New York Times is really interesting because it poses this why question. I mean, if you've got all the money in the world, so that's not an issue. If you're a Donald Trump or you're a Dianne Feinstein or you're a Nancy Pelosi or you've got all the dough, so it's not a question of you needing the job and you needing the benefits or anything like that. It's not that. Why do people hang on beyond their, I don't know, beyond their sell-by date? And I'm going to argue Joe Biden is hanging on beyond his sell-by date. I mean, just look at him. There's no question about it. You know, what is it that drives somebody to, even in the face of aging, what is it that causes people to refuse to let go? 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. And it's one of the reasons why I think there needs definitely to be age limits on elected office and age limits on judicial offices. And we can argue about what that age limit might be. The one I kind of settle on is like 75. But beyond that, you look at Dianne Feinstein, who is 89. You look at Joe Biden, who is 80. You look at Trump, who's 78. Now, I think he's nuts, but I think he's an energetic 78. But he's still 78 years old. Why is it that these people cannot give it up? And is it a good thing? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. Oh, man, take a look at my life. I'm a lot like you. I need someone. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Yeah, that bumper, that Neil Young bumper music is exclusively the province of my producer, Charlie. So, but it is a valid point. No, okay, so Dianne Feinstein, 89 years old, she's a mess, okay? She's been out of the Senate for a month or two, serious health issues, cognitive problems. They bring her back. She's in a wheelchair. Everybody says she's having a very difficult time doing her job. And yet, she intends to hang on until her term ends in 2025. Why is it that so many of these politicians in particular think that they age like fine wine when, you know they don't. And that's just the reality. And you see that. I mean, again, I don't want to turn this into an anti-Biden thing, but I was watching him coming back from the G7 conference over the weekend, and he looks really old. And you could just tell. God bless him, and I wish him a long and happy life. He shouldn't be the president. He's just too old to be the president of the United States. And I think most Democrats would say, okay, we want a Democratic president, but we'd like to have one that's, I don't know, a 65-year-old whippersnapper as opposed to somebody there. So why is it that people hang on so long in politics in areas where you couldn't do it? You know, big business doesn't let you do it. 65, 70, you're out. Law firms, you're out. Sports, you're retired way before that. Dave in Watertown. Dave, good afternoon.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
Good.
I just wanted to say, I think it's a matter of pride and ego, the reason why these politicians don't want to jump out of office, and a matter of they maybe don't see anyone that's good enough in their mind to fill their void.
Yeah, so, that indispensable person, yeah.
And then on top of that, I think they also feel pressured that they have to keep that seat, whether it's Democrat or Republican, keep it a Democrat and Republican. If they know they are a sure vote, that's, I think, a big reason why they stay in.
Yeah,
I too would like to say.
No, Dave, thanks for calling. Well, except, I mean, here's the thing. For example, Dianne Feinstein, she's a Democrat in California. A Republican isn't going to win California. Actually, most of the people, I think, that hang on the longest are people who are representing states that aren't at issue because you know you're not going to get a vigorous challenge. So the only challenge could come from somebody in your own party, like in a primary. And that's always very, very difficult. You know, you're going to run against this beloved, you know, person, and your issue is going to be he or she is just too old. But I think you're onto something. I think it is the ego. It is the power. And maybe it is the whole idea of self-worth. Well, you know, what would I do if I didn't do this? And I guess I feel in some respects that's very sad that, and I mean, look, and I understand people whose self-image is tied up in what they do. I also understand people who enjoy what it is that they want to do. But at a certain point in time, there's other stuff that you want to do. I love what I do for a living, right? I'm not going to be doing this if I'm fortunate enough to live, you know, another 15 years. I'm not going to be doing it 15 years from now, because as much as I love doing what I'm doing, there is going to be a point where you say, okay, well, if you look at the time that you probably have left, there's other stuff that you want to do as well. But there's something about politics that people just cannot give it up. Jeff, it's a mind game. You're not old until you're retired. Well, you don't even have to be retired if you're in politics. I mean, you can, if you're Joe Biden, nobody says he has to retire. People can, you know, if he wants, he can craft, you know, something else, you know, that he can do. Jeff, the people that are holding on think the country can't run without them. I think that's it. One of our texts, Jeff, I think many politicians are drunk on power that feeds their ego, and I believe there's denial about their own physical and mental health, accompanying fear of their own ticking time clock mortality. I agree with you. The term limits are necessary. Now, let me be real clear here. I am not an advocate of term limits. I am an advocate of age limits. For example, the president, we say you got to be 35 years old to run. I think we should say, all right, you can't run again after you're like 75. I'd say the same thing for Senate. I'd say the same thing for Congress. If you're 74 and you run and you get elected, that's fine, but then you can't run again. I do the same thing for federal judges, federal appellate court judges, and Supreme Court judges. At some point in time, you do not do anybody a favor by hanging on beyond your sell-by date.